Rising cases, closing businesses, and shortages of protective gear in hospitals. No, today's show is not a rerun. We're going backwards on the coronavirus. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, June 29th. Glad you could join us today. On the program, a series of updates on the state of the pandemic. COVID-19 infections are surging in Arizona, Florida, Texas, and California. Some hospitals in those states are struggling to cope in ways that other parts of the country have already seen. Healthcare workers without enough personal protective equipment, using face masks for days, wearing trash bags because there aren't enough surgical gowns. No, this is not a story from March. More than 4 months into the coronavirus crisis, why hasn't the personal protective equipment supply chain caught up? Marketplace's Mariel Segura has that one.
When the pandemic hit this spring, hospitals were not ready. They didn't have enough masks or gowns or face shields. Cindy Zolnarek, CEO of the Texas Nurses Association, says healthcare workers in Texas saw the dire shortages of protective equipment in other places. Now they're wondering,
will we be faced with what New York saw, what Michigan saw, what we saw occur in Europe?
3 months after hospitals faced the most severe shortages, things have started to get better. For instance, 3M, which makes N95 masks, has doubled its production to make more than a billion of them a year. But it says the demand for masks still exceeds supply. Dan Hirsch is a managing director at Alex Partners.
The spike in demand is really, really massive.
His wife is a nurse in Detroit, one of the cities that was hit hardest in the spring.
In the heat of COVID, at least here in Detroit, it was 15, 20 times a day that nurses would have to put on a new mask, a new gown.
It's especially hard to meet the need for N95 masks. They're made with a special kind of fabric. Also,
in terms of the really good quality N95 masks, there's a bottleneck because you can't just set up a new company today and start selling those things. It's months of regulation.
That's Lloyd Armbrust, who started a manufacturing company in Texas that makes surgical masks and can make N95s, but hasn't gotten approval yet. Some people are optimistic that healthcare workers will have enough protective equipment this time. Stephen A. Melnick, who teaches supply chain management at Michigan State University, says that's partly because other countries have flattened the curve.
If you take a look at the EU, if you take a look at Canada, if you take a look at other countries, Australia, for example, you'll see that they're on the downside significantly.
Which means less competition for protective gear. I'm Mariel Segura for Marketplace.
Now, you heard us list off some states where cases are surging: Florida, South Carolina, Texas, Arizona. Many of these are states that imposed fewer restrictions early in the pandemic and opened up the most over the past couple of weeks and are now pausing that reopening. Texas and Florida have ordered some bars and restaurants to close back down. So let's try this again. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to look into what the epidemiology says about how to reopen without reigniting a pandemic.
The Trump administration's messaging about COVID-19 prevention measures hasn't been clear or consistent. But with cases surging nationwide, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar sent a clear signal yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press.
We need to social distance. We need to wear our face coverings if we're in settings where we can't social distance, particularly in these hot zones.
These hot zones are concentrated in the South and Southwest, states where restaurants and bowling alleys and salons have started to welcome customers, and people have headed indoors for the air conditioning. That's a perfect environment for COVID-19, says Johns Hopkins epidemiologist Caitlin Rivers.
As we all speak and cough and sing, we produce droplets, and those droplets are how other people can get infected.
Rivers says people need to reduce that droplet sharing with hand washing, distancing, and mask wearing, and by avoiding being indoors with other people who aren't in their household. Her advice to states where COVID-19 is surging:
many of them should look at pausing, not continue to reopen more and more activities, but first try to get that level of transmission back down to make sure that we don't reach a point where healthcare systems are becoming overwhelmed.
More testing is key to broader reopening, says University of Minnesota epidemiologist Ryan Demmer.
If we can scale up, test more frequently, and we'll have a better ability to pull people out while they're infectious, and the rest of the economy can continue to move forward at much lower risk of outbreaks and hotspots.
And just because a state has reopened and officials say it's safe to go out and shop again doesn't make it any more likely consumers will do that. John Lear at Morning Consult says hard numbers are driving consumer confidence, COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths.
That means that consumers can sort of see through some of the politics, and their eye is on the underlying health situation in their region or across the country.
Lear points out, since mid-June, when COVID-19 cases started surging, consumer confidence has started falling again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, yet another deja vu moment, that consumer confidence falling, the virus surging, markets just going bananas. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If there is one thing we could not do without to keep work and school and any modicum of human contact going during these past few months, it's the internet. And that is an essential service that is not evenly distributed. Over on my regular show, Marketplace Tech, we've been doing a series called The Internet is Everything, looking at the access, infrastructure, and the cost of getting online. And according to Mignon Clyburn, a former member of the Federal Communications Commission, race and poverty play a big role in who gets reliable access to the internet and who doesn't. Mignon, welcome to the show.
It is my pleasure.
So I want to talk about the cost of getting online, basically, and how much it varies depending on where you are in the country. What can you give us in terms of the lay of the land and the really big disparities in cost?
I can tell you that it costs way more to live in a rural area. It costs way more to live in an area that is lower income than it does in a high price area. It is not uncommon for you to pay $150 per month for a less than robust internet access.
And is that mostly a function of infrastructure, or are there also, you know, competition constraints?
In urban communities, some of that is about redlining. There have been cases that have been shown that the infrastructure was not built, that robust offerings were not realized in rural communities. You see more satellite options out there, which cost more and oftentimes may not give you that robust coverage.
Right. I mean, I think that I really want to put a fine point on this, because I think we have had conversations a lot that talk about last mile problems and accessibility. And you're saying that the disparity in internet access is also a reflection of social disparities.
Absolutely. So you're going to follow the money. You're going to follow the quote unquote smart investment. You're going to, you know, follow the places where you've got mixed use or other businesses that you're going to make most of your money from. But if you're in a community where I sit, where I grew up, where it is definitely the working class individual where they live, you're not going to see as many options. You're not going to see that investment either on the roads or what is under the road or attached to those power lines because it has been assumed by those that the less affluent you are, the less likely you are going to use these advanced services. And honestly, that is totally incorrect.
So when we talk about internet as a utility, as a matter of classification, do you think that that is what is going to be necessary to essentially force companies to build out an infrastructure that's equal for all?
What you have seen out of this is the price of not being connected. Now you're seeing other businesses who are disadvantaged, other educational institutions like the colleges who don't know who's going to walk back into their doors or, you know, who's going to be able to sign in and sign on. They're being disrupted too. So the lack of that investment by the government, private industry, and by nonprofits have intensified this very imperfect storm. And, you know, that is was always one of my biggest fears when I was at the FCC. Now it is a nightmare for millions.
This fall, your former employer, the FCC, will spend has announced it'll spend $16 billion to provide broadband service to areas of the country that don't have it. How much do you know about this and how hopeful are you?
So if you were to just look at the headlines, you would be ecstatic. You know, it will affirm to you that the agency is investing in a connected future. But what the headlines do not tell you is that you can build it to my home, to my doorstep. But if I cannot afford the monthly cost of service, then it means nothing. It does nothing for me. What the FCC has not done was to look at the Lifeline program, which seeks to directly provide economic assistance to those who cannot afford broadband service. That program has effectively been gutted by this administration, and now we're paying the price. I am willing to bet my next breath that some of the conversations that we're having now that are painful, that are going to be incredibly expensive, we could have avoided some of those costs.
Mignon Clyburn is a former commissioner with the Federal Communications Commission. Thank you so much for the time.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you.
You can find the rest of that entire series, more on cost and infrastructure and policy and the human effects, over at marketplace.org/internet. Okay, so speaking of that pandemic that's still raging and putting businesses big and small in jeopardy, those businesses have one day left to get approval for loans from the $130 billion or so that's left in the Paycheck Protection Program. Over the past few weeks, we've been talking to businesses that applied for and got their loans early in the program. Now that it's winding down, for now, we asked Marketplace's Justin Ho to talk to businesses that have been getting their applications in at the last minute.
Back in April, a PPP loan sounded like a lifesaver to Richard Marks. He runs a professional training company, a business built on face-to-face meetings, which haven't been happening. But he doesn't have any employees, so from the outset, he wasn't sure whether he was eligible for a loan.
My interpretation was that I had to have employees on a payroll in order to apply for PPP.
About 2 weeks ago, Marks heard from another business owner with no employees who got a PPP loan. So Marks applied, and the SBA approved his application this past Friday. He's relieved, but wishes he'd known sooner that he was eligible.
If you're not plugged in, if you don't know what you don't know, you end up missing out.
Some business owners are resubmitting applications at the last minute, even though they've been trying from the beginning. Holly Drews co-owns a pool and spa contracting company. She'd already applied 4 times.
I was just like, checking my email. I've never checked my email so much in my life, constantly checking to see if I got anything.
She was rejected 4 times, once because the first round of PPP money ran out. Another bank said she couldn't apply without an existing account. After a while, Drew said she gave up hope. She was even thinking about taking out a personal loan to keep her business running. But last week, she applied through a new bank and got approved.
My husband and I were ecstatic. It's been a very stressful few weeks for us financially.
Not everyone's quite there yet. Sherrard Duvall runs a media production company in South Carolina. He's applied to 7 lenders for a PPP loan.
It's been a 3-month slog and struggle, and frustrating is probably the best word to describe it. Upsetting, really.
One bank did approve an application that Duvall submitted a couple weeks ago, but he still hasn't heard whether the SBA has approved it. He applied through another lender last week. It's asking for more paperwork.
So it looks like I'm going to be down to the wire.
Duvall says the PPP money would help him pay utility bills, rent, invoices he still hasn't paid. But at this point, he says he has very little confidence that he'll receive any assistance. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
coming up.
And use the word recommended instead of required.
What a difference a single word can make. But first, let's do the numbers. Incredibly, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 580 points, 2.3% to close at 25,595. The NASDAQ gained 116 points, that's 1.2% to finish at 9874. And the S&P 500 was up 44 points, 1.4% to close at 3053. We mentioned those states that are allowing businesses to reopen. Investors saw hope that retailers would soon reap those benefits. Gap closed up 3.6%. Express rallied 6.3%. American Eagle flew up 4.9%. And TJX, the parent company of TJ Maxx, grew 2.4%. Hope springs eternal. Bonds rose slightly. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 0.62%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Last week, House Democrats unveiled a $100 billion broadband bill to bring accessible, affordable, and high-speed internet to communities that have long been unserved and underserved. But how do we decide where to invest? Nicole Turner-Lee is a fellow in the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. She spent some time looking into the type of data that would be needed for a project like this. Nicole, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me, Molly. I really appreciate you, you know, bringing me in.
All right. So to start, let's talk about the data the FCC is using to decide where to deploy broadband. It is my understanding this data is not good.
No, it's been interesting. I mean, the FCC has put out data using its Form 477 that is essentially a way for them to track where broadband subscriptions are. And that number sort of brings us to a range of 20 million plus without access. And in some cases, I've seen some studies where they say 100 million. So we really, Molly, have a huge problem when it comes to collecting the accurate data around where broadband is deployed in the United States.
And so then what are the follow-on effects of that? What does, you know, incomplete data mean for who gets access when?
You know, it's really interesting. I mean, I would say pre-COVID, it probably mattered, but now during COVID and post-COVID, it matters even more, right? Because when you don't know where broadband is deployed, you find yourself in the situation that we actually saw with educational institutions. 53 million school kids sort of mandated to stay at home. Out of that, about 15 to 18 million, we believe, without broadband access in their neighborhood or in their household. Because without that data, you know, the absence of it makes it just so topsy-turvy and so unclear on how we begin to solve the digital divide.
And how much of that, I wonder, has been left to, I mean, it sounds like what you're describing is really an underinvestment, but I wonder to what extent have we also left that up to companies to kind of dictate and decide, especially companies that in a lot of cases have regional monopolies?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that is somewhat the case. You know, a lot of the data that goes into the FCC's reporting is contributed by the companies that are actually building those networks. And so as a result of that, the coverage maps that we see are largely dictated by where the return of investment is, right? I mean, what we're finding out, for example, and I just had a call about this earlier today with school districts. You had schools who were becoming sort of the new negotiators of broadband contracts who had no idea about the coverage that was within their own school district. And so I think, you know, again, to your point, you know, this has not become a priority among the government, and perhaps we need to change that.
Yeah. And actually, I know that we called you to talk about this, broadband deployment and data, and now we are talking in the midst of nationwide and increasingly worldwide protest. And I want to ask you, it's my understanding you've been following that too.
Yes.
And I want to ask you about communication and narratives and social media and internet access in this time also. What are you seeing and what are you thinking?
You know, I think that all of this for me blends together because you're so right. I mean, had we ever thought that we would go from a pandemic to protests? And so I'm very torn at a period like this because I'm a huge fan of being able to use our technology to share our stories. That is how Black Lives Matter was created. That is why we saw the first police shooting really publicly televised, which is Walter Scott in South Carolina many years ago when he was gunned down by a police officer and it was caught on tape. But But at the same time, my heart sinks as what we're seeing sort of dictated and portrayed through technological interfaces are giving us two visions of two Americas where really, you know, there's one side that really cannot breathe right now for a variety of reasons during a pandemic, right? And we have no way out. And to me, that is the most disheartening thing as a mother of a Black son and as a citizen of the United States of America to be witnessing this.
Yeah. Yeah. Nicole Turner Lee is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate your team.
At the top of the show, Mary Ellen Mitchell looked at the surge of coronavirus cases in several southern states, one of which is Texas. That state's governor, Greg Abbott, has been scaling back the reopening process, asking some businesses like bars and river rafting outfits to reclose, but permitting most already open business to continue operation. The San Antonio Museum of Art reopened its doors in late May and can keep those doors open.
I'm Emily Sano. I am the co-interim director of the San Antonio Museum of Art in San Antonio, Texas. In March, immediately from closing, we started producing online activities. And because of social media, the awareness of the museum has gone up. We have had a lot of new people signing up for programs that we never knew before. And the tangible result of that is that more people are buying memberships. We got a wonderful note from a gentleman in Minnesota who tuned into something and decided to become a member. The thought of reopening definitely presented a challenge to the San Antonio Museum of Art. Naturally, the first concerns were about health. So, we in Texas, that the governor announced early on that masks were not essential. We did at that point consider with our task force, well, shall we loosen the requirement and use the word recommended instead of required? But we decided against that because we did not know. Memorial Day had just happened. People were out all over the place, and no one had seen yet whether or not there was any effect. And lo and behold, there was an effect. We have begun to feel the effects of the Memorial Day reopening as the numbers of COVID infections in Texas has dramatically risen. So we are glad now, in retrospect, that we kept the requirement to wear masks in place. Some people have come to the museum, not too many, probably about 40 in the last 2 weeks without masks, and we have given them one, and they will wear them.
That was Emily Sano, the co-interim director at the San Antonio Museum of Art. We reached back out to museum staff this morning and they told us they plan to stay open and that, quote, museum leadership is monitoring the situation closely and will continue to evaluate based on new information and guidance from city and state officials. Share what's going on in your personal economy with us online at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out, this pandemic has, as we have seen, all kinds of unexpected ripple effects, one of which is cake. Costco confirmed this week that it's no longer selling its very popular half sheet cakes. You know, the ones that are a staple at birthday parties and graduations, sometimes the occasional wedding, the delicious ones. Well, Costco says more people are buying 10-inch round cakes, and they just don't need a cake that serves something like 50 people, to which I say, I could happily eat 50 people's worth of cake right now, so just give me a dang sheet cake already. And before we go, a moment of economic context. Deals are still happening as businesses try to pivot to meet the moment. The athleisure clothing maker Lululemon announced its first acquisition today, $500 million for the home fitness startup Mirror. Mirror makes a $1,500 wall mirror that streams workout classes because, remember, we are almost certainly not reopening as fast as we thought. All right, we got to go. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. And I am Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.